Hi, so I'm Simon Clark. I'm on the SharePoint team, and I'm going to talk to you a bit about FSS HTTP, which is kind of the mouthful that we call internally COBOL. That's not the public term. It's just an internal term that's much easier to say. So if I say that instead of FSS HTTP, then that's what I'm talking about. I don't have a clicker. I think just sort of stay somewhat close to here, I guess. So really want to talk about what the protocol is, what we use it for, and then a bit about how it's structured. And internally, there are a set of different layers to the protocol, and I just want to go through each of those and tell you what they're for and how they relate to each other. A quick example. The example's actually not fantastic, but it sort of illustrates a little bit about what's going on. And then relate it back to the documents and talk a bit about the structure of the documents. So as I go along, if you've got questions, just please, you know, fling them at me and we'll talk about it. So what is the protocol? So it's our protocol for client-server interaction for cloud-based documents and scenarios around those, such as multi-user editing, efficient access. So we'll talk a lot about optimizing for size of change rather than size of file. So the key scenario here is I've got my 500 megabyte PowerPoint deck and I make a single character change. We don't want to be moving that whole 500 megabytes back and forth. We look at a lot of WAN-based optimization scenarios. So we want to be as least amount of chattiness back and forth. So the protocol is all about batching changes and establishing dependencies between requests so that we can make the minimal number of round trips. And somewhat sort of internally, the kind of the direction that we've been going with the protocol is that we're ultimately sort of trying to decouple our applications from their file formats. And so when you look at applications like OneNote in particular, its interaction with the service and with servers is at a higher level than bits in a file format and a sequential stream of bytes. There are a bunch of scenarios where we do really care about file formats, and the way that the Word, Excel, and PowerPoint interact with the server is very much in terms of OPC, but it's sort of about having flexibility in that space. So we get a lot of questions about, well, why are there all these graphs and sort of this complexity in the stack, but it's ultimately about sort of being able to have more flexibility in the space. So we talked a little bit. Efficient file transfer is a huge one. Multi-user editing, so this is the co-authoring that you see in Word and PowerPoint and OneNote. OneDrive for Business, the sync engine there, which is a combination of the what we call Groove.exe and MSO Sync, that uses the protocol to do efficient bytes over the wire. And all this adds up to, when we look at our service and the interaction, around for office documents, a 75% reduction in network bandwidth and I/O in our backend storage, and about 45% overall when we look at all file types. So it's significant. We get a lot of bang for the buck, which is. So talk a little bit about what's actually in the protocol. So at its core, the protocol has a mechanism for representing requests and tying those requests together, putting them in a batch, and sending them to an endpoint to be executed, and then returning the results. And then using that, we then define a set of services that then fit into that request model. There are the more obvious ones, which are the co-authoring and multi-user services, and these are kind of pretty obvious requests for taking shared locks and exclusive locks. There's an editor's table, which is just a roster of participants in a multi-user session. You can add and remove editors from that session, from that table, enumerate the table, and as such, and access metadata associated with the clients. Then the meat of the protocol is all in what we call the storage and sync model. And these are a set of requests for enabling the efficient file transfer back and forth. And that's where people find a lot of the complexity lies. So I'm going to sort of dig more into that and not focus so much on the co-authoring services unless people have specific questions. So client-server interaction looks sort of like this at a very high level. You've got a user addressable resource on a server. We think of this as the file model as being the main content of the file, a set of locks and another sort of metadata state, and then what we call partition metadata. Think alternate streams in NTFS, where you can have a main file state and then associate other data with the file for various scenarios. Co-authoring uses this. So in addition to the main document state, Word is writing a set of XML into the other partitions that describe where the other users are in the document and what the locking state of various paragraphs are. And these partitions function totally independently of the content, but everything's tied together. So if the file moves, if the file is deleted, everything's managed as a single state. And then the client is sending these requests back and forth, and the requests are, we use the word request internally to mean one of our FSS requests, which are then all encoded into a single post request that we post back and forth. I won't dig into it too much, but within the requests, you can say, I'd like to download the, actually a common example is, I want to push these changes up, and if there's a conflict, I'd like to download the current state of the document. So again, you can sort of set that up within one request batch and then minimize your service interaction as things like coherency and conflicts happen. I touched on this very briefly. So before we jump into the actual data services, the editors table, simple locking semantics, and these metadata channels. And again, if you've got questions, just let me know. But I think they're pretty self-explanatory. I would touch on, I guess, the shared locks are the sort of the most interesting aspect of the locking semantics, and they're there primarily to separate non-co-authoring clients and co-authoring clients. And so it is possible, actually, and I believe the documents will explain this, to implement some of the co-authoring without the shared locks present. The system will work, but you'll get interesting interactions and sort of a degraded user experience when somebody comes along with an old client. So it's actually well worth implementing them. Any questions so far? Okay, so the storage and sync model. So the high level summary is that instead of representing a file as a stream of bytes, just a big byte array, we choose to implement it as this structured graph. And at the end of the day, the graph is just going to carry payloads of byte data, blobs. So you can think about what we've done is we've said instead of you getting one big byte array, you get lots of byte arrays, and you can structure them and relate them together to expose various properties that we'll get into in a second, and then address it much more incrementally. So of course, you can take a big file as one big byte array and stick it in, we'll show you in a second, in one of these graphs as one single node and use that. But you won't get any of the benefits of structuring it more. I think I've got my next slide. Let's go to, have I got that? Yeah, no, I'll just explain it from here, sorry. Instead of a file being this byte array, a file is what we call a set of cells. And a cell is kind of the top level node in this graph. And a cell, within a cell, you then have a subgraph of what we call objects, and those objects they create a graph so they have edges between them, and the objects within a cell can then point at other cells to create a big sort of cell object graph. And trying to remember which slide I have next to describe cells and objects, but I'll just tell you. The whole point of this is that the cells define what we call consistency boundaries, so the unit of transaction and what you can update, and the objects define the unit of change. So if you make a change to the smallest level of replication is an object. And so clearly if you were designing a new application for this, you'd want to structure your data to align user change with the objects, and then you'd put those objects into cells that define good consistency boundaries. So a great example is OneNote, where they basically all of the text and the structure of the page maps to these objects, and then the pages are put in their own cells, so they can update independently of each other. And so whenever you're thinking about sort of cells and objects, think objects for efficient transfer and cells so that you can make, so that multi-users can make changes to the same document without conflicting. Because if I make a change to, you know, if I make a change to one cell and somebody else changes that same cell and we both upload, somebody will win and that other person will conflict. But if we made changes to different cells, those can both be committed at the same time, because there's no, the model allows that, excuse me. I have a tickle in my throat. The model allows that from a consistency perspective. So this is all implemented using this layered system, and it's basically built on two different graphs. We have this thing we call the storage graph, which is the very low-level primitive storage constructs for actually doing the storage and synchronization. And then the object cell graph is then built on top of that. And then we have application schemas that define ways to organize cells and objects. The two main ones are the OneNote, what we call the OneNote graph, and then the generic file model. And the generic file model is a way of taking just any old file and representing it within that cell graph to at least get some of the benefits of the system. Okay, so the storage graph is that lowest level thing, and this is the data structure that we spend most of the time actually worrying about storing, synchronizing, and reasoning about. The object graph that we'll see in a second is represented in terms of this, and it's basically comprised of these two different node types, what we call data element nodes, which are these immutable data nodes. So they carry arbitrary data that can be defined in terms of how we use this. They have IDs, stable IDs, that, and again, because they're immutable, once you know a given ID for a given data element node, you know the data that is associated with it, or it defines the data that's associated with it. And then one more node type, what we call index nodes, and these are very small nodes. They are they basically just have an edge to another child, but these are mutable and these can be changed, and everything then has to be represented within that type of graph. The index nodes exists so that we can actually avoid the propagation problem, where if you have a completely immutable graph and you want to change one small node at the bottom, you have to change all the parents that refer to it. But if you have these index nodes, you can kind of break that change propagation. So once you've got this storage graph, sync is actually reasonably straightforward, because it's just a question of exchanging these data element nodes that clients don't have. So if you're a client and you need to get in sync, you can ask the server, well, give me all the data element nodes that I'm missing. You'll never get a conflict there because they're immutable, and then receive the set of index nodes that have changed, and again, these can change or be new, and then the only place that you have to reason about conflict is within those at the index node level, and that can be set up to be reasonably well-defined and easy to deal with, and that's what we try and achieve. I sort of add a note that the data elements are a really powerful thing because they're these immutable blobs. So we can cache them, we can they make a very easy and sort of, you know, powerful construct in terms of how you reason about the data. So we've actually talked a little bit about this. So the object graph is the actual graph that the applications use and represent their data in. You've got your cells, you've got your objects, cells consistency, objects, units of change. And it's really up to, in the sort of arbitrary sense, in the general sense, it's completely arbitrary how an application might use this. We internally define the models for Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and for OneNote. And so we'll talk about how we do that. But you can imagine a completely different application that came up with their own model for using this. I'll touch on this briefly. I just want to make sure we don't run out of time. So within the object graph, you can imagine that you've got a cell and you're making changes to it. At any point in time, we define the current state of a cell with what we call a revision. And a revision has an ID. It's an immutable construct. So once you know a revision ID, you know the state. You can reason about the exact state of the cell. And you can kind of imagine how you would encode and represent a revision, because it's just a list of objects for that cell and with the state of each object. So an object state is the actual data it has and the child edges, so the references it makes to other objects. So you could imagine you've got revision one, the quick brown fox. So let's say I then want to make a change to that cell. Well, one way you could do that is you could represent the new revision. It has to be a new revision because they're immutable. With a complete encoding of all the objects in that. Or you could say, well, I can leverage this immutability characteristics of revision to make an encoding which references the old one and then just augments the state that I've modified. And we call this concept revision chaining. So you can see in revision 2, we've modified object C. And then you can do that again with another revision, again referencing revision 2. And so the way you then build revision 3 state is to sort of, for any object that you can't find, you just keep going back in the chain. And this is one of the mechanisms that we support for representing and encoding actual change. It has advantages in that it's very simple. It has disadvantages in that at a certain point, you actually have to maintain this thing because it can't keep on going forever. And so you either need to sort of smush all the objects back into a single one or play with the direction of the arrows and re-encode. So there's sort of pros and cons. Using the storage graph, you can do other encoding mechanisms as well, which don't involve revision chaining, but it's a simple illustration. Are we doing on time? Okay. So you've got your cell object graph, and we need to store it. We store it by encoding it into the storage graph. And the best way I can sort of try to explain to people to think about this is, imagine if you'd come up with this cell object model and then you were told, you know, you're a dev and you've been told that you have to store it on a disk somehow. You could do that. A reasonable way to do that might be just to sort of come up with some XML schema and just write it out into a DOM and then save it on disk. And in a way, the storage graph is kind of that XML, that base XML layer for us. It just has these very basic primitives, and we define a schema involving all these different terms that I won't go into right now because it's probably too long, but the various parts of the graph, so subgraphs describe revisions, they describe the state of cells, and if you sort of actually kind of go through it, it's a relatively simple mapping. There's some complexity in how we represent the revisions, but it's all about the sort of multiply referenced. Are we multiply referencing the object data, or are we creating these chains and all that stuff? Once this cell object graph has been represented in that storage graph, you can kind of then forget about the cell object graph and just think about syncing the storage graph. So this is all very well and good, but what do we do with sort of our traditional Office apps? So they use the OPC file format, which is basically a zip file. It is a zip file. And we integrate at the zip file level. So zip files are comprised of basically an arbitrary number of zip items, which have a header and some zip data, with the compressed data, and then a directory at the end. And what we do is we take that file, we find all the headers, we find all the data in the directory, and we define cut lines at each of those points throughout the file. And then we take those, and I think this is going to animate. Ooh. Keep on going. So we take those, and then we represent them as leaves in a cell object graph. and then build a very simple tree above it. And so the file is represented in this graph, and the actual data for the file can be recovered by just doing a depth-first traversal and then a sort of a concatenation of the leaves to create the original file data. But when it's in this form, we now have a mechanism to be able to very efficiently update it. So if you've made you saved out a document in Word and then you make a change, all we really need to do is find out which chunks changed, update them in place in this tree, make the necessary changes into the storage graph, and then let them synchronize back and forth to the server. OneNote's very different. OneNote we touched on earlier, they actually define a very rich schema within the cell model. So they have a master section cell, and then each page is represented as a different cell, and they have objects within that that represent the various elements that exist on the page. And so they get very efficient synchronization and very localized transactions and consistency guarantees, which enables them to do incremental updates all about the objects. Your consistency guarantees are all about not being able to have to merge and being able to do incremental load of the notebook. That's why when you open a OneNote notebook, you'll see all the page tabs come in incrementally in the background. You couldn't do that if they were all in one cell, because the underlying system would have to deliver the whole thing to guarantee consistency. So then for all other files, we use remote differential compression's filter max algorithm, which you run on a file and it defines these split points. Very quickly, the best way to describe this algorithm is that instead of taking fixed blocks within a file, it looks for local characteristics of the document data, so that if you do an insertion at the beginning, things remain consistent. Think paragraphs in Word. If you chunked based on paragraphs and you insert a character, only the first paragraph would change, and it's very similar, but at a generic level. And we do the exact same thing. We represent it in this tree. We can then make incremental updates to that tree and reconstruct the document again by using a depth-first traversal. This is a very, very quick and simple example. So you've got a client that hasn't opened anything yet. You've got a server that has a document. The document is comprised of these index nodes, so the mutable state, the immutable state, which are the data element nodes, so the cat sat. Obviously, it would be a lot more complicated in real life, and it would be an encoding of that cell object graph. But it doesn't really matter. It's all just those same two primitives. So the first thing the client says to the server is, hey, enumerate all the changes you have for me, and I've got nothing. So that's fairly simple. The server's going to enumerate traverse the graph, and for each of those nodes, it's going to determine the client doesn't have it. So it just sends those back. So it encodes those into the response in the protocol, sends it back in the response to the query changes request. And so the client now has that state. Let's just say in the scenario that somebody else is editing the document, makes a bunch of changes. So those changes look like edits to that graph. Again, much more complicated in real life, but they're all just going to be new data element nodes, never any changes, and updates to the index nodes. So a couple of index nodes will change. In the non-OneNote case, there are only ever three index nodes. So it's always very simple, actually. There are a lot of data elements, but not very many index nodes. So then the client is now going to sync down those changes. It's going to make a request to the server saying, hey, enumerate my changes with the query changes call. It passes this thing we call knowledge. It's in the documentation. Knowledge is just a compact representation of what the client has. One way to describe what the client has would be all of the IDs of the data element nodes, because those are unambiguous, and then the version of the index node that it has. And we use this concept we call serial numbers. It's in the documentation, but serial numbers are just a way of basically stamping each thing with a known version, for want of a better word. So the client's going to send that to the server. The server's going to find that the client doesn't have that was quick and impressive. The client doesn't have those the data elements on the right there, and these updates to the index entries. And so the client can then just apply those. It knows when there's conflict because it would have a conflict at the index node level, and it can run merge or do whatever's necessary to resolve that conflict. Any questions on that quickly? It's a pretty basic example. So just making sure I get through this. So we've got a bunch of documents that describe this, and I'm sure people who've been looking into this are familiar with these. I'll sort of say up front, and I think I've said this before, the actual encoding of the protocol that we use is a little messy from when it was developed. There were various teams doing different parts of it. That's why some of it's XML, some of it's binary. We really do need some of it to be binary because we want an efficient encoding of all those objects. That's important. But you might ask yourself the question for the higher level ones, why is this binary, why is this XML? It's sort of water under the bridge and a good example of shipping organizations rather than software. So that's why there's the HTTP document and the B document, and there's a sort of interesting split. We have to deal with it too, so sorry. The plain document is all of the XML encoding and all of the co-authoring requests and the locking and the editor's table. The B document is the binary encoding, and it's all of the storage, the self-storage layer. So that's where you'll find all of the query changes and the put changes and the graph business I've been talking about. And then the D document is the description of the generic model, how we chunk a file and how we represent it. So these two documents sort of define the generic model, and then the D document describes how we Microsoft use it for Word, Excel, and PowerPoint, and the Office document cache. There is a MS-1 document that describes the OneNote schema, and that's actually, there's a lot more to that, actually, because it involves a lot of OneNote stuff, but we'll go into that. So then just sort of to wrap up, kind of you've got the protocol's just a set of these requests all batched up and related, and there's an encoding, and yes, the encoding involves this XML and binary, but at the end of the day, that's all it's describing. And then we've got our storage service with these two graphs. In a way, if you're not writing an application, you really don't care about the cell object graph. It's interesting, but you care about the storage graph, so you care about these data elements, which are these immutable blobs. That's interesting. You can do caching and lots of things with just that property in mind. And the index nodes are, in the non-OneNote case, just three key value pairs. So those are very small. Sync and conflict all depends on these IDs being maintained and being stable. So if they change, even if they change consistently, the clients will behave differently with that because they won't have a consistent view on what they think their sync state is. And then another sort of thing to kind of point out is that because the system is inherently incremental, when you look at a conversation happening between a client and a server, you're not going to see the complete file state. You're going to see the deltas going back and forth. And I mean, that's a consequence of the system. That's the whole point. But it does mean that some scenarios, such as sort of scanners and inline antivirus, a number of other things, become just much more tricky because you can't see the entire state. And lastly, this is kind of obvious. I mean, there's a bunch of complexity in here. Some of it's a pain because of those documents or the encoding. The encoding is complex. It doesn't need to be. We might fix that eventually. The rest of it, these graphs and things, there's complexity there to enable these scenarios. Take time. With the locks and the editor's table, the worst that can happen is a co-authoring session behaves erratically. With the storage graph, the worst that can happen is you drop data and corrupt user data, and that's obviously a much more serious consequence. That's it. Phew. 3 minutes left, or I think so. Sorry, that was quick and kind of hopefully useful.
Quick question. So I remember from the last Plugfest that the work folders, I think, uses the same protocol.
The which one, sorry?
The work folders.
Work folders?
It was a new feature that was introduced like for BYOD kind of scenarios where you could map your work folder to something in the cloud.
I'm not familiar with that feature. The question is this related to work folders?
Like, does work folders use this protocol too? Because you just mentioned OneNote and the Office files.
I'm not familiar with work folders. It may be called something different. So the only thing I can think of is the OneDrive for Business feature. So that's basically the evolution of shared document libraries in SharePoint.
Right.
And this does use that for client synchronization.
So is the schema for that defined? Like, how does it use it? Like, you have application schemas for OneNote and Office. So which one of that?
So if it is OneDrive for Business, then it's using the generic model with the zipping. So we only currently have those two schemas for production.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yes?
Can you explain this knowledge that is transferred between the client and the server? Because it's not properly documented, it's all saying there's some kind of waterline knowledge, and you try to
explain
this.
So the question is, I'm going to do this quickly. The question is, I have 15 minutes? Oh, I won't do it quickly then. No, I thought I had 1 minute. So the question is, what is knowledge and whether it's in the documentation? It should be in the documentation. If it isn't properly, we will fix it. So again, knowledge is the way that a client says, hey, just tells the server what it has for change enumeration. And that is the scenario. And when we were designing the system, we've got the things that describe a client state are the data element IDs, and those are unambiguous because they're immutable. And then we had a problem of, okay, well, what are we going to use for the index entries? Because they have IDs. The key is the cell ID or the revision ID. But they're mutable, so that doesn't actually describe the state. And then we had this other problem that data element IDs, if you have a lot of data element IDs, you're going to have to send those to the server every time you have a conversation. So we wanted a much more compact representation. So we came up with these things we call serial numbers. And serial numbers are just another ID, and they're associated with with each of those nodes. So we put a serial number on the data elements, and we put a serial number on the on each version of an index entry or an index node. So every time you make a data element, it gets the data element ID, which is used as its for the referencing in the graph, and a serial number, which is just stamped on it. And every time you create or change an index entry. Each time that happens, it gets stamped with a serial number. And then when you describe the change, when you want to describe the changes that you have on the client to the server for this enumeration, the knowledge is the set of serial numbers that you know about. And so that unambiguously then describes your client state. Now, the serial numbers are actually issued by the server. So when a client has local changes that hasn't synchronized yet, it puts serial numbers on them, but I think they're all nil, or they don't have to be defined. And then when it sends those changes to the server then stamps all the serial numbers on it. When the next client downloads that, it gets the all those data element nodes with the IDs plus all these serial numbers. And then when it wants to describe its state again, it takes those serial numbers and uses those for the change enumeration in the knowledge. The key was that the server did that allocation of serial numbers, and we do that so that we can make sure they're all sequential, and so they then all compress down to being a range. So they're the same. A serial number is a what we call an extended GUID, so it has a GUID and an integer component, a number, and we engineer the system to have the same GUID for all serial numbers, or as much as we can. And so you then can describe a whole bunch of serial numbers with just a single GUID and then a range saying, you know, 1 to 1,000,000 would represent all of those very succinctly. That's the main thing in knowledge. Knowledge can also carry sort of arbitrary data and that we do not define in the documents because it's implementation specific. So any implementation can add whatever they want. And one of the things that if you're implementing a server, you find very quickly is that, okay, it's great that you have all these serial numbers and you can enumerate this graph, but that's kind of inefficient because you have to load everything, and maybe you've just got everything in rows in a database and you just want to write a sproc to very quickly sort of carry on where the client left off. And so that's where these waterlines come in. And so SharePoint, And again, this is a SharePoint-specific implementation thing, so the client doesn't need to know anything about this, and the server could change and do something else. But it stamps, when it sends changes to a client, it will put a waterline in that knowledge, so that when the client comes back, and it's just basically a, you know, we have rows in a table, and we stamp numbers on those, and then we have a cluster index on it, and the next sync, we can then just use that, we can get that serial number out of the knowledge, the client doesn't even know this happened, and then start enumeration. Does that make sense? So knowledge itself is it's defined in the protocol, the concept of knowledge, and then the serial numbers being part of knowledge is defined because you need to know that as being part of the protocol. But then there's extensibility in knowledge, and that is not defined, and that is up to the server. The server can do whatever it wants. So you could send back, if you had some piece of data that you needed to send back to clients that you wanted returned, you could put anything you wanted in there.
I've seen sometimes that the serial numbers in the knowledge does not match the serial numbers that are stamped on the objects or data.
The client, I can't remember if our clients actually care, because I don't think they do local change enumeration, so they probably, I'd have to go double check, because if you're just a very, very simple client, you really don't care, right? You've got this blob of thing, and you just send it back to the server whenever you need changes. Our clients get lazy about re-updating their internal serial numbers if they don't need to, because that's a cost. We don't want to go back to the disk to stamp stuff we're never going to need. So there might be a little bit of sort of implementation tricks in our client that are just not updating things when they don't need to. But in general, everything should be documented in terms of when the serial numbers are stamped and what they are. But again, you can return anything you want in there. Just don't make it too big, right? Any other questions? Okay.